Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. My sources have just informed me it is Wednesday. And that's another day here at Faith Radio to keep the main thing, that would be Jesus. He is on the throne, and it is him we are accountable to. So let me get your day started with this idea. Psalm 105, verse 4 says, "Keep your eyes open for God. Watch for his works. Be alert for signs of his presence." So I always think that's divine appointment opportunities. You know, keep alert for signs of his presence when you can have conversations, when you can connect to people, when you can find ways to reach the lost, and hopefully you've got a heart for the lost. And there's a great verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the comfort and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God." So we've received comfort. We can share that comfort with people who are in need of it. And usually we can do that by being alert for signs of his presence, because he is going to connect you to other people today, and you can minister to people. You can love them where they're at. You can show them the love of God today. And that's a great thing. All right. Let's do a little bit of Bible brush up and or reminders. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you in studio as always. The word impute, what is that word? Should I give you that definition, or do you want to take a shot at it?
I believe it means something akin to attribute.
Okay.
Like it was given to, or you can provide the definition at any time.
Yeah.
While I mumble my way through the rest of this.
A giving or sharing of a quality, good or bad, with someone else so that that quality is completely credited to them.
See, that's what I meant.
Exactly. You nailed it. Once again, you nailed it. All right, now here's another reason to be very nice to the deacons in your church. Do you know what the word deacons mean? It literally means table waiters. And that is, in the church, deacons are church members appointed to serve the church in practical ways.
You know, those titles are a lot less glamorous once you know the translation.
No kidding.
But that's pretty cool.
So when you see a deacon at your church, you might want to go, "Hey, waiter, over here." No, you don't want to say that. You want to say, "Hey, thanks for serving in such practical ways."
I like it. I think that's a great plan.
Yeah. So what do you think a locust is? What is a locust? A locust.
You mean like the insect?
Yes, exactly. What does it look like?
Don't trick me too hard. I haven't had coffee this morning.
I get that. I've got some here, but I'm not sharing.
I felt like this was a trick question.
It kind of is. It's a large grasshopper. That's what a locust is. You know, sometimes you hear it and you go, "I don't even know what it is." It's a large grasshopper. When they gather in huge swarms, they will eat all the crops in their flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And in a holy agricultural society, a plague of locusts is unstoppable and catastrophic. So there you go. There's a locust, and then the word deacons and impute. So there's a little brush up for the morning. All right. Now, what is technology doing to our brains and to us? It creates a captive audience. We need to learn how to put away our technology, and then we need to help break our technology addiction in ourselves and with our kids. And then there's something interestingly called the X plan. And I want to tell you what it is and why your family will need one. And we're going to discuss that with Arlene Pelican when we return. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Good morning, everyone. Glad to have you with us. You know, you might be one of those people that your hand gets shaky when it gets near your phone because you want to reach for it, you want to check things, you want to update social media. Seems to be that for social media, if you're addicted to Facebook, it gives you a chance to make new friends because you probably just lost some old friends because of Facebook. You know, the way that works out, it's kind of a zero-sum game sometimes. But we might be using social media too much to the place where we're isolating and we're withdrawing, and we're not as social as we should be because we're spending too much time on the phone. Arlene Pelican is an author, and a speaker, and a blogger, and she has got some really great insights on how we deal with social media. And so she is on the studio line. Arlene, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. You know, I thought about it recently. I saw this article in the Wall Street Journal, and the headline was, "A Captive Phone Can Be Liberating." And it was the author, Joanna Stern, talked about how she went to a party and how, like, you would have to check in your coat, you know, at a place. They checked in their cell phones. They didn't have to part with them, but they put their cell phones in a little pouch, and the pouch locked up. And so they carried their little cell phone in a pouch around all night, and then they had to release their cell phone at the end of the evening. And so she just talked about how what a different experience it was going through this party, reaching for your phone, realizing, I can't get to my phone, you know. And it was really humorous because she talked about how, like, first she took out the phone, she kind of fiddled with it, and then she tried to, like, smash it like a tomato can on the wall to see if it could break open, you know. So she's, like, trying to smash it, and she's thinking, what in the world am I doing? But she said, you know, when you're uncomfortable, you kind of do some weird things. She said, I wish I had a pair of scissors. I couldn't get to it. But the party went on. And you just have to ask yourself, you know, what has happened to us as a culture that we think, like, I can't not touch my phone during a party or during a wedding or during a church service, you know, or whatever the case may be. So I thought that was very illuminating that we can invent successfully a pouch to hold our cell phones, that we would actually need such a product.
Yeah, I think the only people that were really happy at that dinner party were the people with Apple Watches. So that they could probably... I'll just check the time, and they're checking email and updating everything else.
Next will be like a little Apple Watch shield. That could be our next invention.
I know. So we're obviously, we're dying for connection. We're dying for having people in our lives that think about us, care about us. And so we're doing that through a lot of social media. And really the solution is to get face-to-face with people and get involved in people's lives. But there is a growing sense of isolation for people that are overdoing social media and everything else.
Yeah, you think about it, and it's nice to connect to people through messaging. That's all good. But if that's all there is, it's like, wow, I've just been sitting here by myself for a long time. So it really, in your calendar, like, put face-to-face time in with people. Like, I will actually meet you for dinner face-to-face. Mm-hmm. We will drink coffee together. You know, all the people that geographically you can actually meet with face-to-face, put that as a priority. And then when you actually do have coffee with them, dinner with them, lunch with them, walk with them, whatever, like, go ahead, and you don't have a pouch maybe, but go ahead and put your phone somewhere where you can't reach to it. You just, in your mind at least, you say that's off limits for a little bit so that you're not sitting face-to-face and you're both, like, staring at your phone, because that defeats the whole purpose.
I'm looking at this article, Arlene, and it's a story about how social media can increase loneliness. And, of course, on the picture is a guy, you know, with his fists clenched and his head, you know, bent down in his arms, in his hands, like he's this lonely, lonely guy. And I don't always think of that as the person who's lonely. I think of sometime the person who's the life of the party, they could be the loneliest person at the party.
Yeah, that you don't know by looking at someone. And you could see someone who seems like they don't have much connection, but maybe they have one or two really good friends and they're totally cool and good, you know. So. Mm-hmm. So I do think it is a question that we would ask about ourselves, perhaps our spouses, our children, and the people in our close circle, to ask ourselves, you know, are they lonely? Are they okay? Do they have the people in their life that they need? Because we may be the solution to that ourselves. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're on our phone so much that we're not noticing our family members, our close friends, what's going on. So sometimes it's us putting away the phone. I like to think of it as a hot potato, that when you're out with people, like, yes, you've got your phone out and you're checking, like, the directions and you're seeing, is someone meeting us, and you're snapping a picture because you want to remember the moment. But when that's done, like, think hot potato. Like, I don't have to think of 10 other things to do with my phone. I need to get rid of this and be here in the moment with whoever it is I'm with.
Well, we are sharing ourselves with others with our phone, too, even when we're in person, because we're carrying around with us a photo album and everything else. And if you say, hey, I got a new puppy yesterday, you go, well, let's see a picture.
Yeah.
I mean, people demand photos on the spot. So, I mean, even our cell phones, when we're face-to-face with people, still become a pretty important part of the interaction.
Yes. And it is very much how they're used. You know, am I showing you something? Are we having this shared experience because of this phone? And that's totally legitimate. And I think of the grandma who takes out the dog-eared picture of her grandchildren,
right.
you know, and shows them to you. And in the same way, we show our pictures. And I think that's good. But because, you know, grandma's pictures, there's only like 10 of them, let's say. And then it went away.
Right.
And for us, you know, you take out the phone and it's like, oh, did you see this video? Oh, did you see this picture? Oh, look at this. You know, and it could be somewhat endless. So in that way, be purposeful. I'm going to show these things and I'm going to put it away. So that we don't spend all the time, like, because there's endless, like, oh, look at this video. Did you see this? Like, it's endless.
Yeah.
Arlene,
what are, what are some of the mental health problems that could come out of this overuse of social media and just smartphones?
Yeah. Well, they do see, they even show, like, with teenage girls, for instance, that there's a higher rate of depression. There's a higher rate of all those things that, as a parent, you don't want your kids to go through. And you think, like, oh, well, if my teenage girl isn't on social media, she'll feel like the odd man out. But really, they look at it and they say, look at these girls are not healthier. They are more prone to depression. They're more prone to anxiety, to worry, these kinds of things, because they're constantly looking through this lens of social media. How am I being perceived? You know, do people like me? Am I pretty enough? You know, what should I communicate? What would be the right? And there's all these questions all the time and this constant checking on one's identity. And so in that sense, it's not as healthy for a girl to have that unlimited use of social media and for a parent to set limits. And obviously all parents will be different on this, but for a parent to say that, okay, no, you can only be on one social media platform, you know, instead of anyone you want, or I'm going to collect your phone every night and you can't go to bed with your phone, but mom, I might get a text or someone might try to reach me. I'm sorry, you know, dad, you be the tough guy out there, whatever it is. So I think for as parents to realize that our child's emotional health, their mental health, it is connected with how much they're using social media.
Mm-hmm. But there is it is a social necessity now for kids to have phone, and they can't miss a text because they might miss something significant. So I can imagine those battles at bedtime are pretty big.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to push back on that just a tiny bit. And I have a middle schooler, so I know this may change a little bit in high school, but my middle schooler doesn't have a phone. And so there are times, of course, my middle schooler may not know things, and he's a boy, and I'll ask him about it. But the real important things, like what he's got to get to and what he has to know, like he'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. His friends will tell him, things will happen, and he'll know. And so it is this trade-off, like, okay, he might miss something that someone says, and he might not get a joke that guys say to each other, his friends.
Mm-hmm.
But what is he gaining by
right.
not having a phone?
Right.
I know that, okay, he doesn't have access to porn at the click of a, you know, right there in his pocket. Or even just, you know, my husband and I, here we are in our 40s, and we're having a hard time not checking our phone all the time. Just that addiction that comes of, okay, what's happening? And you think you give that to a teenager, to a tween, to an elementary school child, their brains don't know what to do with that
right.
constant adrenaline of, what's next, let me check,
right.
let me check.
Right.
So it is okay to think of what are the pros and cons in each situation.
Yeah. Arlene, when we come back, I want to talk about something called the X Plan, which is a very useful tool that uses a smartphone that is going to help kids in possibly big ways. So we'll take a short break. When we come back, lots more with Arlene Pelican. Thanks for being with us this morning on Faith Radio. Welcome back to Faith Radio. I'm talking to Arlene Pelican, and we're talking about some of the downside to overusing social media and smartphones, but there is something that's come up which is very interesting and very useful that parents and kids can use, and it's called the X Plan. Arlene, tell us about that.
Yeah, the X Plan is something that blogger Bert Folks had blogged about. And it was really neat because it got picked up by, I believe, the Huffington Post and People Magazine. And so a lot of people are talking about it. And it's basically having a conversation with your teenager, something like this. Hey, son, hey, daughter, if you ever get in a situation where you're like, I need to get out, like I'm at a party and I really shouldn't be here, or I'm on a date and things are physically going too fast and I need out, but I'm embarrassed. Like, I can't say like, okay, I need to leave now. You know,
yeah.
I want you parents, I want you to know that when I text you the letter X, that means I'd like to come home now, and will you please help me say faith And will you say to me, will you text to me, oh, you know, something came up. I got to take your mom somewhere. I need your help. I'm going to come get you in a few minutes. So it's basically the X plan. So the X plan would stand for what is your, like, danger, danger, I need out plan that a teenager can tell their parents. And then for the parent, what it means is when you come home, I will not ground you for whatever it is that I found you doing. I will not ask you a million questions. I will not go control freak on you. So this is hard for the parent because the parent might find, as Bert Folks blogged about, the parents might pick up their child and they're not even where they're supposed to be when they get picked up.
That's a good point.
And of course, right? And of course, the parent's response would be like, what in the world are you doing here? You know, and so part of it is the parent saying, I will so make this a safe place for you that I will come, no questions asked, and I will rescue you. And typically what's going to happen in that scenario is whether it's that same night or a few days later, that child is going to say to their parent who has put so much trust in them, that child's going to say, like, okay, here's what happened, mom and dad. And so it's this whole idea that because the thought that Bert Folks talks about, he talks to a lot of kids who are in addiction and recovery and all this, and so he has seen what kinds of trouble kids can get themselves in. And if there's a parent who will say, no questions asked, I will come and pick you up, he says, you know, that is better than a child thinking, oh, I can't tell my parents because my parents, I'll get in so much trouble and they'll give me the third degree and I'll regret it. And so they stay in that situation that they really shouldn't be in. So for the parent, one thing that the blog points out that I think is so good is this is like when you go on a cruise ship and they give you all the instructions, like here are the life jackets, here's the drill, et cetera, that before your child gets to the party, before your child gets to the age where they're going to get themselves potentially in trouble with drugs or with the opposite sex, et cetera, you have these kinds of conversations like, honey, if you're ever in a situation that you're not comfortable with, you can tell me and I will come and I'll come get you, no questions asked, and you start having these conversations. So your child knows, okay, I've made some bad choices and I really shouldn't be here. Your child knows, okay, I can reach out to my parents and they will come get me. And that's what Bert Folks, the blogger, talks about as the X plan.
Because for a kid to get a call, and I would imagine this is how it works, you type X and you text it to your parent, and then the parent calls and says, honey, right, I need you to get home right now. There's an emergency or something. And the kid kind of does the shoulder shrug and say, boy, you know, I got to go. My mom or my dad needs me. And they need me to leave now or they're coming to get me. And it does just save face for the kid, gets them out, because I imagine they're dealing with tons and tons of peer pressure. And at that age and stage of life, peer pressure is pretty important.
And it's kind of funny. You can talk to your child because there were, you know, over 600 comments on this blog post. And some of them were like, okay, now that the X plan has gone public, you know, any kid's going to know, oh, they see the X, oh, you baby, you want to go home, you know. So you can talk to your kids that there can be many different codes that you can have. My son was like, I'll text D for D-Day, you know. So it's like, and then we were laughing. He's like, I don't even have a phone, but someday I'll do that, you know. So you can have different plans that there are different codes or different things that you can say, or if you know your child is going somewhere where they're not exactly sure if they're going to like it or not, you as a parent can say, hey, you know what, I'm going to call you at 8 o'clock. And if you say, oh yeah, mom, how's the dog? Then that's like your code to say, I'm really uncomfortable here. Can you please come get me? You know, you can have these kinds of conversations. I remember talking about this with my parents. This is in the 80s. If someone asked me on the telephone, you know, that was attached to the wall to come over for a sleepover, but I didn't really like that person enough or feel comfortable at their house, but I didn't want to say like, oh, I can't sleep over. Mm-hmm. So I'd like wink at my parents and tell them like make the little gestures like no, and I'll ask my parents, and then I'd say, oh, I'm sorry, my mom or my dad said that I can't come. And it's that same idea, like giving your child that support to say, hey, I'm there for you, and kind of brainstorming together, you know, how can we make this not look stupid, which is kind of a fun project to do as a family.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Arlene, because as a kid, there was the family phone, which sort of sat in a room, which if you wanted to talk to a friend, you went and sat in a chair in front of the phone and talked on it, and virtually anyone who wanted to hear your conversation could, including your parents. Nowadays, with kids with their little private phones, they go off into their private areas and they have their private lives and private conversations that parents don't necessarily have access to.
It's the communication. It's like, is that communication there between you and your child?
Yeah, so if we're going to, you know, not be too intrusive into our lives of our kids, but we want them to know that you don't necessarily get to have this entire private life where you get to have all these private communications. I mean, I don't know how you do that as a parent to make sure you stay involved in whatever they're exchanging with their friends without being too much of a snoop.
And I think part of that is when you give your child a cell phone, that you have this talk in the cell phone contract, things like that, to say, this is what this means. Because as long as you're living under my house, you're under 18 years old, I'm paying for your cell phone plan. You know, like you as a parent have the right to know things, and that privacy is not there. Now, when your child's 18, when your child's an adult, when your child's in college, they can have all the privacy they want. But I think it's okay for us parents to say, okay, you're 16 years old. That's great. I know you're driving. I know you're doing different things, but you're still under my roof. I'm paying for your cell phone plan. Maybe the kid is paying their own cell phone plan, which is a good thing also, but you're still paying room and board. You still have a right to know what's going on there. And it's okay to be upfront with your child to say your safety is more important to me than your privacy.
Arlene, thanks so much. I'd like to talk some more, but I have to check my cell phone. So we'll talk again.
You don't have it in a pouch?
Well, no, I don't. No, my hand is trembling as I want to reach for it. So, I'll talk to you again in a couple weeks. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks so much. We'll take a short break and be right back. Minutes after the hour. I hope your day is starting well. Bill Arnold here. If you're like me, your body is producing that sensation of hunger. I don't know about you, Rebecca, but I'm feeling that way. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, Kent Kaiser is going to be in studio. We're going to talk about some of the things going on with Obamacare and its problems. And that guy kind of knows a lot, so I'm looking forward to that. We'll be back in just a minute. Most of us know we need to make a healthy change of some kind, but when you're trying to change, you will have moments of weakness. Pastor Rob Ketterling offers these words of encouragement.
I think the attack of the enemy is to put guilt on you so you quit. And my thing was, we're all going to have moments where we slip. We don't intend to. We're not excusing ourselves, but we're human and we're being attacked by our own flesh, okay? And when you do that, you just get right back up. You get right back up. You figure out who you want to be in Christ, and you go after it again. And maybe you confess. You figure out what was the thing that was wrong. Did you bring something within proximity to you? Did you let your guard down? Do you not have an accountability partner? Was it a weak moment? Alcoholics Anonymous talks about hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Halt. Were you hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? And you slipped up. Put a guard up in those areas. Get strength from the Word of God, from the Scriptures that are there for you. Ask for help from God. Get the other things out that were causing you to fall and start putting the right things in that will get you towards your destination.
You can find the full interview on our website, myfaithradio.com. We will take a short break, and when we come back, Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. Back in a minute.
If you were to list all the things needed to have a church, what would you put on your list? This is Jim Garlow. I'd like to suggest that for us to have a church, we need to have a mutual ministry. Put another way, the marks of a true church are the preached word, the sacraments properly administered, evidences of discipline, and finally, ministry. What do I mean by that? Ministry that occurs within the body. Not the church having a ministry, but a church that is ministry. Jesus described the meaning of ministry quite clear in Mark chapter 10, verse 45. He said, "I did not come to be served, but to serve." Jesus declared further, "Whosoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave." In simple terms, ministry equals servanthood. Both pastor and laypersons, ministering servants together. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Minutes after the hour. Usually on Wednesdays, we have Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio, and today is no exception. I always appreciate his willingness to be informed and coherent. Always a key. I think of him as the University of Kent Kaiser because he's so smart. He's like a one-man university. But he is the chair of communications here at the University of Northwestern, and we're going to talk today a little bit about the Obamacare stuff and its problems and what is it going to take to pass. This is a mess, Kent.
It is. There's a replacement bill out there that I personally think it looks good. It's at least a move in the right direction, and yet it's getting criticized from both sides. It's interesting to see the conservative side says that it's still going to be too expensive because it keeps some of the things that people actually liked about Obamacare, including that you can still get insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. And another thing that people really liked was that you could keep your kids on it until they were well into adulthood, I think age 26. And so people liked those things, and those are part of the what's kept in this replacement package. But some conservatives are just referring to it as Obamacare Lite and saying that it's still too expensive. It still has this expansion of Medicaid that was in the original Obamacare bill, which would earn that law. That would continue to expand Medicaid through 2020. And some say that that's just too expensive. And of course, on the liberal side, they just don't like it because it's not Obamacare and they don't want to replace Obamacare. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens now in the negotiations. It's in its respective committees in the House and in the Senate, and there will have to be negotiation. The president tweeted about how the bill is out there for everybody to see. And by the way, this bill is much more understandable than Obamacare was. As people probably remember when Nancy Pelosi said something to the effect that we'll have to pass the bill before we can read the bill and know what's in it, which sounds insane, but she actually said it. And this bill, they're saying, go out and read it because it's easy enough to understand. And the president tweeted about how it's out there for everybody to see and ready to be negotiated. And so we'll see what happens. What will be interesting to see is how involved the president himself wants to get in this, because I think he's going to want to have a victory in this. In other words, to get something passed that would replace Obamacare. But it'll be interesting to see with the legislative process. This is a messy process that he's probably not really accustomed to see how willing he is to really seriously negotiate and go and maybe twist arms and butter up some of, you know, maybe the conservatives who aren't necessarily on board with it right now, what kind of deals he can strike to get the thing passed. And it'll also be interesting to see if the Congressional Budget Office comes back, and the Congressional Budget Office is one that is the office that looks at the cost of all legislation and also the impact, the practical impact on Americans. If the Congressional Budget Office comes back and tells President Trump that this bill will result in X number of people being without health care, whether he will have the fortitude to stick to it and see it through and to push for it, or whether he'll back down. And I personally hope, of course, that he will have the fortitude to see it through. I think most people agree that even if we had to go back to a point where there were some people without insurance, that would be a better system overall for Americans because of, the costs of Obamacare are just unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that really hasn't been brought up in this, and it's never been brought up to my estimation enough, is the impact that Obamacare has had on employment in the United States. And I'll tell you how it goes. Right now, if you're a business owner, you are required to provide health insurance under Obamacare, and that kicks in once a person is, you know, not even full-time, but close to full-time. And so what has happened, I think it's like three-quarters time or 70% time or something like that. Well, what happens then is employers are making these decisions like, okay, well, we'd like to give this person more hours, but if we do that, then we're going to have to pay for Obamacare, which suddenly makes that employee way more expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And so right now, if you're a business owner, you're saying, well, rather than hiring this person full time, I'm just going to hire two part-timers. I mean, this is true even here at Northwestern when we're hiring adjunct faculty. We have to look at how many credits they're teaching and make sure that they're not above a certain number so that, you know, Obamacare doesn't kick in and thereby make them prohibitively expensive for us to hire. And this has happened, again, this is at every business. This is happening all across the country. They're looking at the cost of Obamacare and often making these decisions to not hire more or to hire more part-time people rather than making people full-time so that they don't have to incur this crushing cost of health care. And so this replacement bill that we're talking about now would eliminate that particular problem and would, I think, then lead to much more employment across the country. I think a lot of businesses right now feel sort of tied or fettered or whatever you want to say, kind of tied up with Obamacare, not just in the paperwork, but again, in not being able to expand their businesses like they would want to. And as soon as they're freed from those restrictions, I think that many more people will be employed and businesses will probably be much better off and doing better.
Outstanding opening monologue, Kent.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That was long.
All right, here's a couple of questions based on some of the things you said. When you talk about CBO, did I say that right, CBO?
The Congressional Budget Office,
yeah.
Yep.
How manipulated were those numbers when Obamacare was being constructed?
Well, it seems
and how
like,
reliable are they when they're coming out with the new repeal and replace numbers?
Well, we hope that they're reliable. I mean, they're making estimates, and I think most members of Congress do rely on them pretty heavily. I think that there were probably many costs that they did not anticipate with Obamacare. Again, I don't think anybody's been talking about that the cost in the long term of having people not get a job or not be moved to full time because a business has to make this strategic decision not to move them above the level where they have where Obamacare kicks in. And so I think the Congressional Budget Office does a pretty good job of saying kind of what the face of it kind of costs are. But some of those societal costs like that, where people just aren't getting a full-time job, those are things that are not measured by the CBO.
I remember when I think it was Senator Clyburn, Thomas Clyburn, came out and when they had the results of CBO for Obamacare. I remember him just being over the moon. We're just giddy because the numbers have come in, you know, below what we thought they were going to be. And of course, what happened is the cost ballooned way above that. So it was just a complete total mess.
Right. Well, and another component of this, the one area to be a bit concerned about, I think, and the conservatives probably have some legitimate concerns here, is with the expansion of Medicare, or Medicaid, and Medicaid has usually been reserved for, you know, people in, who are less wealthy or impoverished. And Obama, right off the bat, when the discussion was about people not being able to get health care, he's like, well, he made a comment in a meeting once, and a former congresswoman told me about this, how he might have almost like slipped in the meeting where she was talking about how there were these people who would not be able to get insurance, and he kind of slipped and said, well, there's always Medicaid for them. And so all of a sudden you saw like this giant expansion of that because of people who wouldn't otherwise be in there in that system were getting into it.
We'll take a break when we come back. More with Dr. Kent Kaiser. Thanks for being with us. It's 47 minutes after the hour. All right, good morning. It's 49 minutes after the hour, and on Wednesdays, we always have the privilege of talking to Dr. Kent Kaiser. He is in studio, and he made his way across the blustery, windy parking lot to be in the studio on time. And when it's this windy and cold, it's still itching season for me. I don't know about you, Kent.
Yeah, well, no, it's windy out there today. I mean, this is those days when you park away from other people so that they
exactly
don't
board exactly
open their doors. That happened to me here,
but,
like
yeah.
around Christmas time. I got a huge door ding. I saw it happen.
Yeah,
and it was a windy day just like today. So now I'm just extremely careful of where I park.
Is that the guy that was also complained about anonymously getting hit by a snowball?
Probably
that same guy. Kent, let's talk a little bit about the back to Obamacare and how seniors are affected by some of the changes with possibly Medicaid and how the president is at a little bit at odds with the conservatives over this.
Well, yeah, all along the president has said that there wouldn't be any, he's going to preserve Medicare. And I think that's probably the case. I don't think that any kind of Medicare reform is going to make it through the Congress without the president's support. And I think that that's a place where many conservatives would like to go because people see that the system is not sustainable. And yet Trump will say, well, it's sustainable through whatever year. And I think it is some distance into the future. And so I think he's just not even wanting to touch it. And it is a hot political topic because the people who are on Medicare are older and generally vote more conservative. But at some point, that system is probably going to have to be addressed. It probably just isn't going to happen during a Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. I had Dr. David Stevens on this week, and he was talking about the cost of prescription drugs, which obviously seniors have a little bit more interest in. But there was he was using as an illustration this worming pill or deworming pill. I don't think you add worms into your kids, but you deworm them. And he said the pill cost $100, but actually the cost of it was about 5 cents.
Yeah, well, and this part of the problem here happened in the Bush administration when they created this extension, essentially, of Medicare, and that was the prescription drug benefit that they call it, as they call it today. As soon as you start throwing government money on something, the price goes up
mm-hmm.
because all of a sudden it's true in all areas of government. Every time you throw tax dollars at it, all of a sudden the cost goes up because there's unlimited amount of money to throw at it, it seems. And that's what's happened with prescription drugs. That's, by the way, what's happened with a little bit of a tangent, but that's what's happened with the costs of higher education, too. As soon as the federal government starts giving so-called financial aid, well, then all of a sudden students have more money to spend on school. And if you look at where the costs of higher education have really exploded, it's not paying professors, believe me. It is things like housing. And if you just look at the housing complexes that are going up around every big university in this country, just unbelievably nice housing, housing that I could never have dreamed of being in when I was in college or even after college. You know, places
or even
that,
now, Ken, yeah, let's
even
be honest.
Now, honestly, we're not kidding.
Yeah. I see you. You sleep in your car at nights. I see that.
Well, no, but you should see what these students are living in. You know,
it's amazing,
isn't
it?
I see around the University of Minnesota in particular because you see these big high rises and they've got 50,000 students or whatever it is. You just see these big, huge, really what are luxury apartment buildings going up, and
insane.
Students are living in ways that I don't even understand it, because it seems to me that once they get out of school that they're not going to be able to maintain that particular style of living anymore. But I mean, we're talking about multiple room apartments with
washer dryers
in the units,
yeah.
And everybody has their own bathroom. When I was in college, like, you had to go down the hall and there was a communal bathroom, you know, and it was like 70 people on a floor and you had your one little room.
Okay, yeah, there's some visuals I don't want to have now, Kent.
I know, but I mean, and there wasn't like a pool in the building, or a hot tub or a sauna or anything
media
like that.
Room.
I mean, or workout room or anything like that. But now it's just unbelievable. And so, but you've got government money being thrown at it. And so, of course, that's where the costs of like higher education are going up. And it's the same thing with prescription drugs. As soon as you start throwing government money at it, then all of a sudden the pharmaceutical companies say, oh, we can raise the price and we'll still get that price because people have government money mm-hmm. to spend on it. And that's mm-hmm. exactly what's happened.
I want to cover a couple of things real quick before we end our time. The latest cabinet confirmations, Ben Carson, Rick Perry, and Ryan Zinke. Kind of sounds like a law firm of Carson, Perry, and Zinke.
It does.
Have you been in a car accident? Call Carson, Perry, and Zinke.
Now, it's interesting how much attention has been paid to these. They've been strung out for much longer than the usual confirmation process for previous presidents. And they're getting a lot more scrutiny, I think, even in the media. And that, because can you remember who held those positions in the Obama administration? Not really.
I can't.
And all of a sudden, we're all supposed to know exactly who our Secretary of Education and Health and Human Services and everything else is because the media keep telling us.
Yeah. I don't know my password for my Amazon account, so... let's talk a little bit about your former college, Carleton, where you went to school.
Uh-huh.
Had a little demonstration there. And
well, actually, there's a demonstration at the state capitol in St. Paul. And you know, one of the alums, a much more recent alum than I, is the son of former vice president candidate Tim Kaine. That was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate. And his son, Linwood Cain, was among protesters at the state capitol who were protesting a Trump rally. So people there rallying for Trump, happy day, you know, all kinds of, you know, fun being had by the ralliers. And these ne'er-do-wells came in and threw smoke bombs and created melee and were arrested, originally arrested on felony riot charges. But it seems as though the county attorney or whatever is probably going to maybe charge them with something lesser, saying that they can't quite come up with that charge. But it doesn't exactly make one proud to see that someone from your alma mater, like especially a prestigious school like Carleton, would be engaged in illegal behavior. And, you know, the former vice presidential candidate and he's current in the U.S. Senator, Tim Kaine, kind of blew it off in a way by saying, oh, we're proud that our – I can't remember exactly the quote, but something about how we're proud that our kids have differing political views.
And, yeah.
And really didn't condemn it in as strong a language as I think should have taken place.
If I was his son, I would spend most of my energy protesting my parents for naming me Linwood.
Yeah, he goes by Woody.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, Woody.
Okay. That's not too bad.
But, yeah, it's really unfortunate because it reflects very poorly on a school like Carleton.
Yeah. Kent, thanks, as always, for being here.
Thanks for having me
on.
Love
your perspective. It is 57 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. It's 58 minutes after the hour. Good morning, Bill Arnold. We are having a great day here at Faith Radio. Thanks for being with us. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bill English from Bible and Business and find out what's going on. And we're going to have a great hour coming up. So stay with us. Be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.